Fine. Let's immediately go over to South African Quality Assurance, Qualifications Authority. Let me also indicate that we obviously there's a set time that we're supposed to have these engagements in, not because of our committee, but there's a parliamentary committee process. Also to the members to indicate, you know the reason why we had to get SAQWA, NSFAS, Council for Higher Education, the department, and a sample of CETAs before in the next few days was precisely because of the report to Parliament. And so it's not, there is a reason in terms of the budgetary expenditure process that's linked up with the time frame of Treasury, the time frame of government, that is the reasoning. So, although in the normal process we would have done annual reports, I think, until mid-November. And then there would have been enough time, and that's the reason why there's pressure on our time in this particular context. And we've decided we can't not, we have to get the entities in. I think I'm clear now, CEO, that you've picked up some of the questions, but we're also very clear that you also didn't receive the ATC reports, and the same would be for that. So we're not going to get to that point. I think it's a deeper issue. We now know the answers well around it because we've assessed it quickly. And so let me hand over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members of the Portfolio Committee for Higher Education and Training. SAQWA is always pleased to come and report to you on progress of the past year. Chairperson, allow me to make three introductory points. First of all, that we take accountability very seriously, and this is our 13th clean audit report, and in every meeting that we come to the Portfolio Committee, we immediately follow up. Sometimes there are requests. Once there was a request for gender information breakdown. There was a request for an NLRD presentation, and we followed up. So we have a process of reporting back to our board and ensuring that we close the loop in that kind of way. So if anything was reported in those things that were discussed in the Portfolio Committee when we were present, those things have been taken up and the loops closed. I would also like, as the practice of SAQWA is, our chairperson has often come with us to the Portfolio Committee. At the moment, she sends her deepest apologies. She is organizing the 1,000 Women function at UWC for their 50th anniversary and couldn't be here. But it's the SAQWA Act, and following with the NQF, I'm a full board member of SAQWA, and I'm also aided with Mr. Ahmed Esop, who is a full board member, ex officio from the council, as is Ms. Kirti Menon, who is the acting DDG for the higher education. And so if there's anything that picks up here and I report it back into our board, there's again another a quality loop that is there. We take this so seriously, Chair, that I was on leave today on my annual leave at Mapungubwe. So I cut my annual leave short to actually be here because we take this seriously. Chair, and the last point I'd like to make in introductory remarks, I have 1 year and 4 months of my contract left, which will be my third term at SAQWA, and God willing, I would then have completed 15 years. I have no intention of asking for a fourth term. And in the light of preparing the next set of leaders to be able to take things forward, we planned the presentation around that the Deputy Executive Officer, Mr. Joe Samuels, will do the presentation. He'll be aided by our CFO, Mr. Mark Albertine, and we are here certainly to answer any questions that may ensue. Over to you, Joe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm aware of the fact that considerable time was spent this morning, with the first presentation. So I'm going to really, highlight, a number of points. The documentation, the annual report, was available timelessly as well as the presentation. Chairperson, in terms of the overview of the presentation, firstly, an overview of the annual report, firstly, outlining the positioning of the NQF and SACWA, as we understand it, from the imperatives that was developed by the board, and then the progress we're going to deal with, as well as prioritize risks, dealing with intellectual leadership role, model statutory body, continuous improvement, increased efficiency, and then prioritize risks. And then also the way forward, which is the new strategic imperatives that was decided on by the board, in March this year. Chairperson, overall, the our theme for the annual report is work and learning, and you will see as we go through the report, how that ties in, with the work that we have done. The structure of the annual report is, we have the vision, mission, and then the content. There are the forward by the chairperson and the Minister of Higher Education and Training. The Chief Executive Officer's report outlining the strategic matters, and then the Deputy Executive Officer's report dealing with operational matters. We then, report and disclose in terms of the corporate governance. There's a responsibility statement that's in line with the PMFA. Report of the Audit Committee, also in line with the PMFA, the report of the Auditor General. A board report, and then the glossary of abbreviations and acronyms. And then, Chair, an extra A is then the program performance information, that is required, and that the Auditor General also, have a clear look at. Now, if we talk about the positioning of the NQF and SACWA, our approach to implementation of the NQF is that SACWA embraces diversity, environmental sustainability, and social justice in its approach to the implementation of the NQF. This follows through in terms of, what it is that we do and how we do it. The essential role of the NQF, we understand, Chair, is that the NQF is the key mechanism in society to enable communication, coordination, and collaboration across education, training, work, and development. SACWA has got an oversight role, and that means the development of navigational tools, in the financial year that we're speaking about. SACWA is also the custodian of the values of the NQF. It engages on, high-level strategic issues, and then also one of the key discussions, is that in the process of creating a nodal point to accelerate the strategy regarding recognition of prior learning, as well as the development of policy. Just in terms of the RPL, you would see that what we have done is to give committee members a copy of some publications. One of the publications there was conference proceedings that was dealt with by the Department of Education and ourselves, focusing on the recognition of prior learning. As well as, I'll speak about that later, in fact, the research that we're doing in partnership with the department, with the University of the Western Cape. Chairperson, in terms of SACWA strategic imperatives for 2009-2010, it was the implementation of the NQF Act, as well as the related legislation. And of course, Chair, the managing of the transition to ensure effectiveness in the system to the advantage of learners and partners. One of the key things coming out of the Act was a specific responsibility in terms of communication of the NQF and advocacy of the NQF, towards the latter part of the year. The minister then gave a go-ahead, and so also in what we have handed out to portfolio committee members is a copy of our newsletter, as well as two or three, two leaflets, that is beginning to do the communication in terms of both SACWA and the NQF. also build research and development capacity and credibility to lead policy, legislation, and conceptual debates, and I will go into a bit of detail in terms of that. Advancing lifelong learning, including recognition of prior learning, credit accumulation and transfer, and the career advice services. You know, Chair, this has been one of the things also that we've been focusing on, and you know, and in fact, an enlargement of that, you know, of that function that we will report on later. And then develop and maintain international NQF linkages, which is then also within the legislative mandate. If we then talk about the progress, you know, and risks, you know, your Chair, what we have been doing is to providing stability in the new landscape, that through partnering with the Department of Higher Education and with the QCs to implement the NQF, also to, you know, a number of activities, leading policy, legislative, and conceptual debates, you know, to help take us forward. And then, Chair, you know, we've developed a kind of partnership approach to research that impacts on policy and practice, and a little bit more detail later on. Then the establishment of navigational tools to help citizens to find their way through the system, in particular, you know, with the setting up of a helpline. The NQF advocacy, educating the public on the objectives and benefits of the NQF. We have undertaken, you know, particularly, you know, a number of radio programs or pilot radio programs, particularly dealing with people in the rural areas. Also, the acceleration of, then, of the overall strategy regarding RPL, and then, as I said, the career guidance, you know, that we are focused on in the last financial year. In terms of research, Chair, you know, one of the director of research, previous director of research, Ben Parker, passed away, and what we've done is to create a memorial lecture, and that memorial lecture focused on education and training in South Africa, dealing with progress and challenges. And in fact, the first of the Ben Parker Memorial Lectures was given by the DG, Professor Mary Metcalf. The chairperson's lecture focused on the skill shortage, with skills, and for what purpose, the case for researching, work, and learning. And this ties in very much with, you know, the theme of, you know, trying to deepen the understanding between the relationship between work and learning. And then there was a series of seminars that we have had on the transversal NQF concern. In terms of the research partnerships, the partnership with the University of the Western Cape dealing with specialized pedagogy, a comparative study of RPL practices within the changing landscapes of the NQF in South Africa. With the University of Natal, the research on FET college lecturers, you know, biography, knowledge, and pedagogy, where we are saying, where we are investigating whether if one is actually introducing a major reform, whether in fact, you know, the people that must introduce that reform and that new curriculum, whether they're equipped, you know, to do so. And then with the University of Rhodes, you know, change-orientated learning and sustainability practices. With the University of Witwatersrand, specialized communities of practice, understanding the relationship between theoretical and practical knowledge in the workplace and selected vocational training context. Chair, we also entered into a partnership with the Joint Education Trust, where we are looking at an impact study, you know, building an impact study towards an impact evaluation of the NQF, descriptive and a statistical analysis of the responses to the new NQF Act and related legislation. So it is really about, you know, having a look and saying, firstly, the NQF Act is a new act that came into being and so on. You know, how does one describe that at the moment so that it can give us the basis for doing the impact study going forward? The NQF and the career advice, to establish the NQF brand architecture was quite an important one, you know, and then also successfully launch a traditional media advocacy campaign, and you have seen some, you know, some of the you know, some of the media in your pack. Also to introduce the NQF advocacy concept to NQF leaders, the SACWA, and to the QC staff, because it's quite important, Chair, when one wants to, you know, advocate that, you know, that, you know, that staff members, you know exactly what it is that, you know, what are the messages that, that we want to communicate, and in fact that we line up the messages with the kind of service that they, that they're providing. Also, the establishment of a joint SACWA NQF advocacy steering committee that was supported by the Department of Higher Education and Training. This includes the different quality councils is part of the steering committee. We also presented NQF ambassador workshops for staff at SACWA and the QCs, and conducted career guidance consultative meeting with a broader stakeholder group. As well as the role of the NQF support link, you know, to CETAs, the government departments, EFIC colleges, as well as corporate organizations. And then, Chair, the establishment of the NQF outline and the NQF website as precursors to the advisory services initiative, as it were, and really building the kind of infrastructure that is needed, you know, to move us forward. SACWA is also a model statutory body in our view, Chair, that from a governance point of view, this is the 13th unqualified audit report that we've received. We have, you know, looked at and made sure, in fact, that we complied with the King 3 Code. There are a few adjustments that we had to make, but largely we've made sure that we've complied. We have received the full investors in people status, and this is a clear reflection in terms of the development processes that we've set in place, you know, within our organization to meet the status. We've put in place an effective performance and development system for staff, and we have compiled a comprehensive business continuity and disaster recovery plan, particularly for, you know, the career advice, obviously, the information there, but also with regard to the NLD. You know, so that when anything happens, in fact, that we do have the backup systems in place. We've also sourced an off-site disaster recovery site, so if anything happens to the building, that we will be able to set up and run the, you know, run the institution from there. Also, Chair, we've instituted a number of initiatives regarding sustainable environment. It includes a comprehensive recycling program and the installation of a rainwater tank, you know, in terms of that. We also conducted an energy efficiency survey and established an implementation plan, you know, taking us forward. We've also made sure, in fact, that staff understand what exactly it is that we're doing and why. In terms of the evaluation of foreign qualifications, we've done an international benchmarking and alignment to international leading practice. We visited a national recognition centre in the UK, you know, to benchmark, as well as to attend the 21st International Conference of the European Association on Internal Education, again, to make sure that we are, you know, clearly with regard to that. We shared expertise with qualifications authorities in Namibia, Ghana, and Angola. And we've undertaken a huge data cleaning project, you know, so that our database, you know, is able to compare with, you know, with other others and so on. In this financial year, we've received over 21,848 applications, you know, from various quarters. In actual fact, it has been a reduction from the previous year, largely because previously, we had 57% of applications came from Zimbabwe. That figure has dropped to about 40-odd%. You know, so it gives a sense of the stability in the country and so on. In terms of the National Learners' Record Database, Chairperson celebrated last year 10 years of its existence, and we also came, you know, here to make a presentation, you know, to the Portfolio Committee. We believe it's still the only system of its kind in the world, and we must look after that. Chairperson, another significant thing was that the Minister of Public Service and Administration, you know, sent out a notification that SACWA should be used for verifications of qualifications, both of international and of local qualifications, And, you know, we have been building that particular capacity, you know, in order to do both high-level appointments as well as, you know, dealing with bulk verification of staff within the public sector. We've also made available information to key partners and policy makers. In addition to that, Chair, we are also cooperating with a number of bodies, including Stats South Africa, with regard to information management and verification, particularly because we would like to work towards a situation where the information can be, you know, can be declared official statistics within South Africa. And so that partnership, you know, we're trying to develop so that we get to that point. In terms of quality assurance and standard setting, in this case, we've continued with some of the historical functions we required, in particular with regard to the, you know, the quality council and trade and occupation, those qualifications and standards, you know, in the, you know, while they're in the process of being of setting up and becoming operational. We've also co-authored documents outlining procedures and guidelines for academic programs and interim arrangements. And then we've developed an approach and action plan in respect of the establishing of policies and criteria for recognition of professional bodies and the registration of professional designations, because that is one of the new functions, you know, that has been allocated in terms of the NCF Act. In terms of international liaison, we serve on the SADC Technical Committee towards establishment of a SADC Regional Qualifications Framework. We've also conducted a wide range of work internationally with OECD, the Commonwealth, United Emirates, and Mauritius, and we've hosted a number of study visits, particularly from, you know, Ghana, Eritrea, Mozambique, Angola, Ethiopia, and so on. In terms of publications, there's a number of publications, you know, and I think we've shared some of these publications with, you know, with the committee already. Now, Chair, I'm now going to just speak a little bit about, you know, increased efficiency, but perhaps what I need to do is to, you know, before I speak about prioritized risk, is to hand over to Mark Albertain, you know, to deal specifically with, you know, the financial issue.
Honourable Chairperson and members of the committee, I'm going to be fairly quick. As we have said, we did receive a 13th unqualified audit report, but we are acutely aware that it doesn't just go about finances, that it also goes about meeting our stated objectives in terms of our mandate. And really that, in terms of our annual report, you will find that on page 87 onwards, in terms of how we've met our objectives. Obviously, we take very seriously the management of funds, and we do manage responsibly, effectively, and efficiently. We are always looking to see how we can improve in terms of the way that we spend and the effectiveness of our spend. You will see in terms of our budget, we spent 84.2% of our revised budget during the year. That's taking into account that we did receive approval of a further $11.4 million in January, and that was due to the approval of surplus funds from prior years. Then, Chair, this table, you will see it is on page 89 of our annual report, and that really just sets out in terms of what our programs are and the different directorates, what our budget and how we spent it. And then, Chair, the next slide is to really to break down in terms of our under expenditure of $11.8 million, how is that made up? The first part of it is we look at efficiency savings on various different expenditure items, the biggest ones being stationery, photocopying, and printing. Printing there is really twofold. One had to do with the printing in the Government Gazette of Standards, Unit Standards Qualifications, and other ones in terms of publications. Then in terms of professional consultancy fees, use of contractors, there obviously we looked at getting more out of our staff, better utilization of the resources that we had, and then also that partly our restructuring in the Directorate for Foreign Evaluation of Foreign Qualifications played a factor there. Then moving on to the next section in terms of the underspending, we had savings on personnel costs and staff training and recruitment, and that really is a factor of challenges in terms of appointing the right staff into the vacant positions. Now, we have made subsequent quite a lot of improvement of that from the year end of March to where we are now. Then the other major item there is the advocacy, and there was one of the projects was we were just waiting for the minister's approval before we actioned that, and that just caused partly a delay in how the timing of when we spent those funds. So, Chair, that's quickly just really in terms of 11.8 underspent, and I'd be happy to take questions afterwards. I hand back to Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Chair, in terms of the term prioritized risks, what we refer to here is that we do an exercise to see what are the kind of likelihood of a particular risk and what the impact of that might be. If it scores between a figure of 16 to 25, it simply means that, you know, that really becomes kind of high on our radar that we actually need to look at. And then we put particular strategies in place to deal with, you know, to deal with these particular risks. So this is really those, you know, risks at a fairly high level. What we were saying is that, you know, there's new legislation and SACWA's role in the architecture and the transitional arrangement was one of the things that we prioritized, and then we put in a number of strategies to, you know, to kind of deal with that. Also, the effective execution of SACWA's leadership role and the coherent implementation, particularly of the new system, given the fact that there are two quality councils that already exist and one that is in the process of being set up. So that has got implications for the overall implementation of the system. When new legislation comes into being, there's always an issue about clarifying the interpretation of that because different people may have different interpretations with regard to roles and responsibilities of the various bodies, you know, in the new system. I've already alluded to the establishment and the operationalization of the QCTO, which is a key risk that all of us, in fact, and that SACWA in particular needs to, you know, kind of look at. In terms of resources, there's always the question about, you know, having financial support for the planned activities, and on a year-to-year basis, we develop three scenarios. You know, scenario one is really a kind of ideal situation. You know, that is what we would do if we get all the funding, and then a scenario three budget, which is really a kind of budget that says, you know, this is the money that is available. You know, so, you know, so there's a gap in terms of that. And we always, you know, take that into account. Also, a risk in terms of resources is retaining a full staff complement, you know, to implement the planned activities at the required level of quality. And then a number of operational challenges. Receiving the data that is complete and accurate in order to populate the NLRT, because that is quite a significant, you know, part and so on. So, Chair, those are the prioritized risks, as it were, and then going forward, the strategic imperative that is, you know, that the board has developed, you know, for the current financial year 2010-11, and, you know, very briefly, again, it's about positioning the NQF in terms of environmental sustainability, social justice, as SACWA as an oversight body. And the areas that has been identified going forward then is continue to manage the transition, continue to build research and development capacity and credibility, advance lifelong learning through the NQF and mechanisms such as RPL, CAT, and career advice, engage proactively with key partners to develop common understandings, and in fact, you know, one of the key things that has been developed has been the establishment of the NQF forum that is chaired by the DG of Higher Education and Training. And in fact, that would include SACWA as well as the QCs. That is quite a critical part there, Chair. And then, of course, creating the climate and conditions for effectiveness through advocacy and excellent service delivery. So those are the kinds of, you know, issues that we have that the board has outlined going forward.
Chair, I'd just like to add that in terms of the NQF and Career Advice Helpline, that is no longer just a SACWA initiative. It is now a partnership between SACWA and the Department of Higher Education and Training, and it's funded by the National Skills Fund of $99.4 million over 3 years, and we're going to see the results of that. The radio programs that Joe spoke about will be in all 11 official languages, with a special emphasis on the 9 African languages. And so, again, it's reaching people in their own language, which is incredibly important. Similarly, with the recognition of prior learning, this is now going to lead to a national task team to have active interventions to take the island guidance of good practice that we have in South Africa and to make it accessible more widely. So there's again, and that will also be a partnership between the SACWA, and the departments, and the QCs will be asked to play a very important role in that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacs, and as well as to the Deputy CEO. Let me indicate that out of the last engagement, if you recall, there was the following issues raised. The one related to the fact, until with last year's annual report, the previous year, the one, your retention rate of staff, there was, I think, pressure there. You tongue-in-cheek indicated possibly it's a good thing precisely because it's been taken up, then people go to very strategic positions in, not necessarily in SACWA, but in other departments or in the line of duty of higher education and training. I think that was an issue that I can recall. You want to speak to the question around the vacancies that you've reduced, but importantly so, how do we ensure that the representativity, especially when it comes to black, African, male, and female at top management level and management level actually gets corrected. I think that was one issue. The second issue was the RPL that your chairperson, that's linked to UWC, as recall, in fact, SACWA raised that as a concern about take-up in the broader family of higher education institutions. That is an issue that this portfolio committee raised every time subsequently to that. You should also remember you actually gave a report to that effect, not today, now I'm speaking then, because we've asked for an analysis of the matter, and we received that report. So I think we also need to indicate that we were able to raise that issue, and we've picked up that the concern that SACWA has raised is a concern in the institutions and the instruments, even to the point that we are saying to the ministry and the department that we cannot park RPL in terms of implementation for 2016 in the NSDS3 as it was drafted now, because then there's an anomaly somehow. So that's an area that, as a committee, we've identified. If there's anything that you would have wanted to comment on that particular, I'm just reconnecting with those issues. I think the third one, members, it shows the power, I think, of being taken serious. When you look at what the CEO just now said about the career advisory service in the context of money that came and the partnership between NSF, SACWA, and the ministry and the department. Because you can recall that the department, the intention was to draw up a research plan this year in the strat plan, and we said we're not accepting the strat plan unless it actually is accompanied by very clear financial commitment into this process. And I'm hearing now, after we've seen some of the pilots has moved, we are now seeing that, in fact, that has happened, and the funding and processes is there. So clearly, there's a good argument around why we need to pick up some of the issues out of the committee, and SACWA has shown leadership in that. I think we want to acknowledge the fact that you have so many years already unqualified opinions. That in itself doesn't necessarily mean quality is happening and performance assessment is taking place, but clearly when you look at performance and unqualified reports in your entity, there is a balance, because there's many unqualified reports, but we don't necessarily see the outcomes at performance in many of our institutions. In your one, we can see that balance. Just sort of making those comments and want to allow the members then to, I'll start on my far right and go through Member Magazine.
Yeah. I just want to make a comment. I think this is a good, you know, it's a good presentation, and you can see the progress from the issues that we have outlined. And I think, Chair, the SACWA, it can be, I mean, other entities of the sector, they should learn from you, from them. How should they take issues that are being discussed in Parliament? And also, Chair, I don't know, because they have not numbered their plans. You know, where they are talking about doing awareness on their program, I think that, Chair, within internally, so that the staff, they understand what SACWA is all about. And I think also, Chair, that's giving leadership so that everybody, from the cleaner until to your CEO or your minister, you, when you work for the company, you should understand what is this company all about. And I think it also shows the passion. When they are dealing with these issues, they have a passion. They are not just dealing, you know, with these issues. And the issue of transition, because they've mentioned here in the report that they are still continuing with the transformation and transition. I think for me, Chair, I am going to be quiet because I'm really happy. And I think the grace of the Lord has come.
Between a pastor, between the reverend and a communist, there's something that's working.
Chair, thank you. I also would like to thank SACWA for the presentation and the work that has gone into it. Maybe let me just be pickish or pedantic, whatever the right word is, and say that your approach is diversity, you say. You claim that it is. Seeing is believing, you know. I just want to pick on your very, very first slide of the overview, which is the second slide. I'm just being pickish. The next one. The second. You know, that slide. Where's that very first slide? No, not that one. The one with the teacher. The one with the teacher.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
No, I just want to say, you know, no, there's a person, the teacher.
Okay. That's the chairperson.
Is that your chairperson?
Yes.
Yeah. I did suspect that she was something in SACWA, so I have no problem with that. The only thing about it is diversity, not so much in terms of color, not at all. But it's got to do with what you claim to be standing for. You are saying that you are standing for diversity, and you are saying that it's work and learning. She's only teaching and there's no learner. For all I care, she could be a consultant presenting to a corporate, and because there's nothing like what you claim. So I'm just being pickish to say that what you put there is what you must live by. But also, more importantly, is that I would have, if I were SACWA, I would have put on the slide of the intellectual leadership. Because in that slide, it leaves what you claim to be living for. There is communication because you find students there. Maybe you want to put that on the intellectual leadership role. CEO, you want to put that slide on. Yeah. There's coordination, surely, because they are in a laboratory and they are working together. And there is communication because it's more than one. So the reason why you don't have it like that, I do not want to steal the honorable member's thunder. She wants to ask you the question. But the reason I suspect is that it's because there's no woman who has prepared your slide for you. that was on a lighter side of things. But I just like to say that that's more of what should really, you know, symbolize SACWA, because that's where everything that you say you stand for. There's diversity, there's coordination, there's communication, there's collaboration. Surely that's what you see. The second thing really that I want to talk about is your own partnerships. In looking at the institutions of higher learning that you have, I see that, and surely there must be a criteria or some criteria that you have used in order to have those types of partnerships. But again, if you want to leave diversity, we have three institutional types in South Africa as a result of the transformation changes. So what I see here in the main, you've got more traditional universities than you have other forms of institutional type. I wish that you were having some partnership, for example, with a University of Technicon, one or two. I wish you had a partnership with a comprehensive university, so that from the richness of your own instruments as SAQA, you can have a lot of people getting the most from it. So I see that you are dealing with more traditional universities, but also in terms of the spread, you find that those have got more an urban focus than you have universities that would be out there. So I'm just calling for diversity, but I'm also calling for the kind of quality that draws itself from everybody in South Africa, as much spread as possible, in terms of the outreach, rural, peri-urban, but also in terms of the institutional type. Those were really there. The last one, I think the chairperson did allude to this, was the whole issue of personnel, the savings on personnel. I think we can try to save on a lot of things, but if you save on personnel, it means there is that kind of person that you do not have, which you need. That's why you have the saving. But I also think that the CFO did allude to that. Just wanting to red flag it is an issue. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Good comeback there, Honorable Makuza, on that introductory remark. Maybe Mushwana.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have three questions. They're very short. And the first one is much of a comment than a question. I note that you hosted Ghana, is that one, Eritrea, Mozambique, Angola, and Ethiopia before. Now I'm checking what informs this particular choice. Is it you wait for those who want to come and then you host them, or do you initiate taking into cognizance the poverty of our closest neighbors? They might definitely need to learn something from this country. Should they not see that they need to learn, do you take an initiative, like trying to invite them? That was the first question. And secondly, I'm checking why within Understand you should have advocacy. Because to me, advocacy is a starting point. If you want to succeed in whatever you do as a structure or an institution, it's good to start with advocacy. Because then you bring everybody on board. But then if this particular advocacy couldn't go on, because if I heard it correctly, the minister could not okay this or did not... can we talk of changing time frames to make sure that by the time it must happen, the minister should have seen it? Because when I go to your way forward, which is the final remark that I want to put, you still talk of creating the climate and conditions for effectiveness through advocacy. I think we speak the same language there. But then how do we ensure, because I don't see how you have spoken of maybe changing the time frames to ensure that by the time you want to do it, the minister has seen it. Thank you very much. Forgot. There are three women out of 11 maids.
She
should I say call, please behave?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Order.
The three women that we see here, it's cause for concern, because this country, the last time I checked, we have more women, especially in education. We have actually more female educators, and even if you go to these elites, actually we have a lot of women. To have only three and the eight maids, what informed this? Didn't they make it in
interview?
Or did we inherit the lot of the most of the eight and only added three? I'm checking, because if it's like that, we need to do something to change this scenario. Thank you.
Colleague has all the questions from our side, but I'm particularly interested in the Peach Research Symposium. I would like some more information on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to make a few statements and then give the gentleman an opportunity to respond to that, please.
And as long as you don't read the statements from the page.
And if you would accept that, it would be a bit of a devil's advocate statement that I'm making. The first statement would be NQF should accept responsibility, or at least co-responsibility, for the backward slide in the number of qualifications attained in the South African education system. The fact that there are a number of artisans qualifying, etc., they've all dropped. I believe it has to do with the framework of these qualifications, and that is too complicated, too expensive, and not suitable to the South African conditions. The second statement is, SAQA should also accept responsibility for the growth in the demand for international and private qualifications within South Africa. And by that I mean people doing City and Guilds qualifications, Microsoft qualifications, Bosch diesel mechanic qualifications, etc. Then also, SAQA should accept co-responsibility for the problems experienced by various ETQAs, and the fact that those ETQAs have not been able to lift themselves up to the standards required. And then lastly, if you could comment on SAQA's role in the fact that South African qualifications are quite often not held in high esteem internationally, that when some of our people want to further their studies internationally, that they don't get recognition for that, and that they are required, before they can do certain qualifications, to repeat the prior work done. Your comments to that, please.
Can I also say that it would be important for SAQA to actually answer the question around how authentic is a statement like that, that SAQA or South African qualifications is at times, generally being seen as inferior. That it would be interesting just to hear SAQA's comment on that statement. Take into account that I'm looking for more than 1,000 engineers, professional engineers, that sits in the UK, and we actually want to get them here to do the work that they're supposed to be doing in South Africa. Member Khadebe.
Thank you, Chair. Well, Chair, I understand the Honourable Mushwana's concern. She's a former teacher, you see. So she can apply and get the position, the soccer. Because I could see that maybe soccer's got a problem with the leadership position, because as I see here in your report, many people are resigning, board members. You know, sequentially, May, there was somebody resigned, November, somebody resigned, 31 December, somebody resigned, October, somebody resigned. That is 2009. Hello? I mean, you look at these consistent people resigning. I'm trying to check whether they do you have any leadership problems, whatever. Because I'm just looking in terms of the consistency and in terms of the continuous leadership within SAQA. And yourself, you intending to retire. I'm just wondering what's going to happen to SAQA. I'm really getting worried. But if I can be able at least to get a briefing in terms of that, because we must be able to keep the ball rolling. We should not have every time new people, because in terms of accountability, people will say, hey, I don't know from the previous leadership what happened. Must be able at least to keep consistency. I appreciate the fact that you're transferring your skills to your deputy so that you can take over and the likes. It's a good thing that you can be able to do. But also, the other thing that I was interested in is that the chairperson's lecture on the skill shortages, I'm trying to check and assess what impact has it done, and where were these lectures, in terms of demographic spread.
Thank you. No more questions from Member Khadebe's side. Member Kubai.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is not necessarily a question, but just to appreciate the presentation and echo the sentiments that have been said by the colleagues. Chair, I just saw the document that speaks on RPL, And my appeal to you, Chair, would be somehow can you find a day where we can have all the role players that were either part of this or are part of the RPL, specifically talking to the findings, some of the engagement that they had. There are quite a number of interesting things. I've just perused it through. I'm seeing it for the first time, which I must acknowledge. But what intrigued me, there's a part where even talks about the challenges of implementing RPL. As a committee, we've been dealing with this matter quite constantly. We have been raising it with various stakeholders. And each time when you raise it with somebody, somebody passes it back. But I'm glad to see this document, and I would want us as the committee have a session with the department and role players just to engage on RPL issues and the implications thereof. Then we'd go back and deal with the issue of budgeting, because even when we were dealing with the budget issue, we were worried as a committee that we don't see reflections of the budget around RPL, either from basic education or higher education or anywhere else. But it's a challenge that I think we are sitting with, and I'm appealing that can we look at this document, have a meeting to deal with it specifically. I would appreciate that.
Thank you, and if Member Magubela is going to ask anything, it's not going to be on RPL. Definitely not.
Fine.
Thank you.
I'm just happy that at the end of the day something is coming out. I think we must just appreciate that. It has taken long, but it seems we're getting somewhere. I think the meeting that she proposes can help take us forward. So I think there's an institution called the Tshwane Institute of Technology. Yesterday it was on the media because they have registered IT and are offering a whole range of other things, and students are paying. Now, in that regard, what happens? I remember the last time we met you, we also asked this kind of questions of those of the institutions that our own people are not registered but are out there. And it's not clear who then enforce that kind of law to then close them down or something. Here they are, everybody knows that they are not registered, but they're offering courses and they've not been penalized. I'm talking of something that even happened yesterday. What's your take on that? What should happen? Do you approach them yourself or you wait until people come to register? Or it should be the department that moves in and do its part? I think the resignations have been up. I won't get into that, Chair. The other, on the fraudulent part of the COVID, the certificate of evaluation on foreign, was it that COVID or how did you pick it up? Can it be that there are many other fraudulent certificates out there which you never picked up and you only managed to pick this one by some accident or some chance, or what are these chances of picking it up? The last one would relate to CETA's accreditation of their own courses. Who does that? Is it CETA themselves who say in this industry, this is what we want to offer, and you are FET, you don't have capacity, you don't even know about these courses, but we must give you these courses ourselves so that you provide to the kind of learners that are from ourselves, or CETAs come to you, you are able to ensure that whatever courses they want to offer are accredited as such and so on. Who does that on their part? Well, to me, there are just some structures out there who may not be necessarily best with the, or residing with the actual expertise, who can then declare that their own courses that they want to fund up and so on. And what pleases me again, Chair, is that the unqualification that they got is without emphasis. Or
yeah.
You know, we do have those that are a qualification, but there are still some emphasis of matter here and there. But yours is saying everything is just clean to the letter, which is far much
Thanks, sir.
Thanks. The last person, Member De Koko.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, just to add a very good report, our congratulations. You said Honorable Makhubela mustn't ask a question on RPL. You didn't say anything about me. Just to say, ask. No, but you see, it just shows that it's something that worries us. Whether there is any single qualification at the moment, or whether there is anybody in South Africa at the moment who has acquired a qualification through RPL. Because I think we've been talking about it a lot, and we write papers about it, we hold seminars about it. Maybe I'm ignorant. To the best of my knowledge, it's not happening. We're just talking about it. Maybe I'm wrong. There is something that SAQA knows that I don't. The other question, just to add on to the question asked by Member Vukuza on the choice of universities. And she talked about different types of universities. Now, even take us a bit back and say, you remember, we used to have something, universities referred to as bush universities and all those things, and the kind of stereotypes related to those universities, how people from those universities are being undermined and all those things. And when I see universities with which SAQA is at a partnership, they are not coming out. I just wanted something there. But also, so that we don't fight about definitions, on page 51, the demographics of their staff there, I just want them to confirm that what is here is correct. They stand by it. They are saying that the deputy executive officer is African male. I don't want to fight with them. I just want to know. Just they can just confirm that what they wrote here is what they believe is true. Thank you.
We can now get responses.
I can, and then I'll ask my colleagues to add in. I'm tempted to start at the end and work my way up, but I won't do that. Thank you, Member Magasa, for your comments as to your positive comments as to other members of the committee. I think diversity is always a tricky issue, not one that we are afraid to tackle. But again, it also depends on the time when you take your snapshots. If I look at the people that were directors at SAQA, and when they left SAQA, where they ended up running CETAS, for example, there's Buhelwa Penkpa, and also Sibilele Nombete, for example, who left SAQA as a director to become a CEO of a CETA. We've also had someone who is now chief director, Sharma Bika, who was a director at SAQA, and she left to go and work at Palama, for example. So it depends on when you take these snapshots and how people come in and people leave. So there's not, in my considered opinion, it's we look hard, we try, we push, we try and get people that represent the kind of demographics of South Africa. And if you look on page 51 of the report, you can see a complete breakdown there of everybody. And maybe this is the opportunity to answer Member Bekoba's question about, you know, in the old days under apartheid, they did a pencil test and they decided to say, hey, where do you go, you know? If the pencil moved easily through your hair, then you were classified one way. Stayed where it was, you were classified another way. Now, this is an ongoing debate that we have had at SAQA, and some of us will say, okay, if you want to call us so-called colored, then you call us so-called colored. Other people feel very strongly about it, and our deputy executive officer felt very strongly about it, and he said he's not going to be classified in that kind of way because he's fought his whole life. And he said if there is going to be some kind of place because the Department of Labor was looking at, because we didn't classify it. We first of all left it unclassified. And then at the end they said, well, you know, then you must declare what he believes him to be. And that's the way that happened. So there's a history in a particular idiosyncratic history at SACWA to that particular issue. So we do take it seriously, but equally, who we do research with is equally important. Now, again, I think context is everything. SACWA has a very small research budget, and it only researches things connected to the NQF. So if people are doing research from the NQF and they come to SACWA and say, we have a proposal around this, and as we go around and we talk to, I spent a long time of my life at Peninsula Technicon, now part of CPUT, and I've said to them, why are we not receiving any? I'll go to Durban University of Technology and I say to people there, in fact, their former Vice Chancellor, Professor Roy Dupree, sits on the SACWA board and he sits on our research committee, and I said, are there nothing forthcoming? I speak to my colleagues at the University of Fort Hare and I said, you know, haven't you got something to put on the table? So wherever we go, we say, but it has to be related to the NQF. And that's the only criteria. So again, there's been no kind of vetting, and you can, if you look at the actual research proposals, you can see it all deals with particular issues that we're all wrestling with, and that's important for taking our education and training system forward. Again, the issue about personnel, yes, we do grow our own timber, yes, we find that people leave, but I think, again, context is everything. We had a long review of the NQF lasting almost 8 years. People were getting restless because they didn't know which way things were going to pan out. When you got an NQF Act, the Department of Labor was supposed to start the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations. There was a reluctance to take SACWA staff like in block, and they said, no, they're going out to advertise. Some of the staff got nervous and they started to look for jobs elsewhere, and the person like Sharma Beaker was a classic case who moved across to Palama, and there were a number of other cases like that we can cite. And again, I think the issue about the diversity in this little book of 3 out of 11 are females, I think that is just when the book was taken. Those were the people that were there. But I do take your point that if we're putting out any kind of advertising, it's very important to balance. We have a young man on one of the things that says, I want to be a farmer when I grow up. And we've got a woman who wants to be a nurse. And I said to them, please, you know, make sure that you change the gender so that, you know, men can also become doctors and women can also become farmers if they want to, so that we get out of the gender stereotyping. And I think that's an ongoing struggle in our society. The Teacher Research Symposium, time doesn't permit us to go into detail. There's a report that's there, and we are always happy to come and talk to members one-on-one or out about it. That was a something that got initiated by the Department of Education at the time, and SACWA was the support in that, and that conference was a very successful conference, and you have the conference proceeding. When it comes to accepting co-responsibility for all the problems of the education and training system, I think as South Africans, we all have to bear a certain amount of responsibility for what goes on in our country, and we can't shed our responsibility. But I really think that the question that I'm always asked is, are standards dropping in South Africa? That's the other way the question is posed to me. And my answer is always a standard one. No, the standards are not dropping. Our qualified doctors and engineers and academics are sought after all over. We have lots of sites of excellence in the South African system, from the schools through to our universities, through to the research institutes. Our problem in South Africa is that the sites of excellence is not standard throughout the whole system. And that's our challenge. Our challenge is to get the standard there. So when we talk about our qualifications, I get calls regularly from New Zealand. This person is a diesel mechanic. The man is 24. So he qualified now recently as an artisan. But the New Zealanders want him to work there as a diesel mechanic. Our problem is that a lot of the problems about the number of artisans is not a problem that we can't train them. Our problem is the way the whole system works to train artisans. And I can give you a long lecture, and I know that we don't have the time to deal with it. So I believe that we all have a responsibility to get our quality up to there. But again, I don't think, even when it comes to the ETQAs, the stories that the public doesn't know is that we put a number of ETQAs on notice that they're going to be de-accredited, and they quickly got their act together, for example. So again, our business is, and if you take that one step further, when the CHE did their work on the MBA, they de-accredited a whole lot of programs that didn't come up to scratch. And so, again, they are in the system where these issues are being dealt with, sometimes not with all the fanfare in the newspaper, but dealt with firmly, and there are providers that get de-accredited on a fairly regular basis when they are not performing. So I think that there are signs there. But can the system improve overall 100%? There is big room for improvement in our system as a whole. If people ask why were there these resignations, again, I think I've explained why the resignations were there. In fact, if you look at all the CCM cases that we were involved in, our record to date is SACWAS won every one of them. We wouldn't get the Investors in People's Award if we were running a particular kind of oppressive management style. And in fact,
2 minutes for you to respond.
Okay. The chairperson's lectures were held all over the country, but mainly at universities. So we had a number at the University of Pretoria, and the latest one has been the University of Johannesburg. Then with RPL, again, we're running on the 21st. It's an RPL seminar. And then next year, the 23rd to the 25th, February, there will be a national event. The issue about the institutions that are not registered, the department, if they're not registered and the department knows about them, the department can close them down. So that is the responsibility for the, and the department gets notified in a number of ways. Then the evaluation of foreign qualifications, no, we haven't found any additional other than the ones we've reported. So we believe that it was an isolated incident. In both cases, the people were fired, and in one case, the person took us to the CCMA, and we won the case. So there's no place for crooks at SACWA. Then the CETA accreditation of providers, again, there's the short question is, at the moment, SACWA accredits ETQAs under the old SACWA Act, and they accredit providers. In terms of the new NQF Act, that function will be taken over by the QCTO, and they, in terms of their plans, will accredit providers in future. So there's a past scenario and a future scenario. And again, the case for member De Hobbe, the people who have qualifications through RPL, our artisans can, those that are semi-skilled workers, can go to Ndlela. They can have a challenge test under the old Section 28 of the Manpower Training Act, and many artisans have qualified that way. How those artisans are treated then by the industry becomes another issue. And in the mining industry in particular, if you haven't been apprenticed on the mines, they don't want to take you if you're qualified, even though you are accepted as a qualified artisan. The other place where Art for Others has been used very successfully is in the insurance industry under the FASE Act, where they have to get a certain number of credits before they can give financial advice to people. And there it's been also practiced very successfully.
Thank you. The last word? Yeah, but Chair, just the issue in terms of the visits and so on. There are 2 points that we made in that slide. The one is that we sit on the committee, the SADC committee, and in actual fact, in that context, we assist quite a lot of SADC countries. I mean, in fact, all the SADC countries, as it were. So there's a clear focus in terms of that. But then also what other countries do, like Eritrea, Ghana, and so on, is to then ask SACCO where they can come and learn, from us. And so, report those visits, kind of separately. So it is both of those things. It is working with SADC countries and then, people taking the initiative to come to visit.
So you've got both a proactive and a reactive strategy dealing with that. There is two ends. And we'll just hear sharp responses.
Mine might not need a response, Chair. Just to highlight, the CEO was talking about Indlela. And I think that as part of that discussion on RPL, we must involve them. But I'm not so sure, CEO, that I can confidently say that Indlela is doing that. I've been raising a number of issues, Chair. Maybe we must follow it up as the committee around Indlela Assessment Center. One, the cost that you must do that assessment, quite high. Two, it has been very inefficient. Third, I know they are seriously undergoing serious challenges, whereby they're even under forensic investigation, that we are waiting as the committee a report based on the annual reports that we're looking at, even on expenditure. We interacted with the DG this last week, and she highlighted that they will bring the report as soon as it's done. But I'm just saying, I have a concern if part of such a huge responsibility lies on India, because I know nationally, currently the QCTO minister says they will take that responsibility, but we don't have anything except Indlela in the entire county for RPL, which is a serious problem.
Thank you. The last person.
No, thank you. Just to respond to, and like I said, that look, these are actually classifications that are not even ours, the issue of Indian colored and all those things. But I guess there's a history attached to it, and there are reasons why we do the way we are. And I know that if Biko were to speak to me, I would say to me, it's an attitude of mind. So he would say, no, I mean, I should be very satisfied with the... But I'm just trying to understand what the CEO would say, for example, if his staff next year were to say, no, and I see, for example, I can just say, I've just randomly picked one. I think his name is Herman Orloff. If next day he were to say, I've had a very serious look and I've applied my mind, I shall be Africanist from today. What would be? I'm just saying that we are required in terms of our laws and where we are now as a country to do that. And like I said, let him agonize about it, because very soon we might come back to the committee and say, do we really have to do this thing?
Thank you. Then we apply the pencil test. That's the problem. We'll speak up if Olof what he would say. Let's not get responses on both. I think that the one of the work was a very important question, because the issue is, if there is that responsibility loaded on an institution, and there is concerns with the institution, obviously then the quality of expectation comes under stress. I think that's the deeper the concern there. But let's thank SACCO and indicate that we support the recommendations even outlined, and some of the steps that you are taking. What's really heartening is to know that things that we've raised, that we can actually see progress of those specific things as you are advancing. And we hope to engage on you in particular on the RPL in the future. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thank you for the day. Thank you.
Thank you.
But no one has asked them to give the diary, because it's fine if they're giving out of the free will, but if we ask them, it becomes a problem. In terms of... so much.
Maybe that's why there were fewer questions.
As long as CHE will have a board member here, then we don't have a problem. Look at how they're responding on that one. thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. Unfortunately, we don't have diaries to give out, so I suspect I may have a rougher time. Let me just start with a few comments at the outset. You know, I was commenting to one of the members earlier that I clearly have developed a career where I appear before this committee presenting annual reports with which I had nothing to do. So last year I met with you around presenting an annual report on NSFAS, where I was a part-time CEO of NSFAS. And I joined the CEO in May of this year, CHE, sorry. So I'm presenting a report for a period of time where I was not CEO. I think it's also an important comment in the context of some of the issues that were raised by the committee with the NSFAS. Not so much about the formal processes and the documents and whether they get sent or not, but in terms of issues of follow-up and so forth. Because in periods of management instability, so the NSFAS is a good case in point, and similarly in the case of the CHE, the fact that there have been interactions between the committee and those entities, when they've either been acting CEOs or no CEOs or whatever the case may be, means that the kinds of continuity doesn't happen, so the responses that you may be expecting year on, in a way that SACCOR with the CEO who's been there for 15 years is able to deal with it. So I think we just need to bear that in mind. Secondly, I should, Chair, we do have a board member, and Ms. Menon is also a member of the CHE Council and the EXCO Committee. I should also just explain, I am in one sense a lone ranger from a management point of view, because everybody else has come with large teams. We have a senior management of three people at the CHE. The CFO, unfortunately, was not able to be here, as his wife is very ill. And the executive director for quality assurance, we are currently doing an institutional audit of the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. So both her and the other directors are involved in the institutional audit. I'm going to present a fairly brief overview. In part, it's the difficulty of having to report on something that I've not been engaged in. What I would like to do is to focus, take the functions of the CHE, and then outline what work we've done based on the assumption that people have had the opportunity to look at the report, but more importantly, to indicate the problems and challenges and what we want to do going forward, coming in from the outside, so to speak. As you may be aware, as members would be aware, CHE essentially has four key functions in terms of the legislation. The first is to advise the minister on issues on higher education, which can either be done at the request of the minister or proactively by the CHE itself. Secondly, this is an executive function, which is quality assurance. It's audits, and the audits I was referring to, quality assurance mechanisms at institutions, the policies, the processes, etc., that they have in place. It also is responsible for program accreditation, so every new program that is offered, either by a public or private higher education institution, has to be submitted to and approved by the CHE, or by the Higher Education Quality Committee, which is HEQC, as you may be familiar with. Thirdly, there are a set of new functions that the CHE has inherited with the National Qualifications Act. The CHE is now a quality council, and as part of its new responsibilities, it is responsible for the higher education quality framework. It's also responsible for standard setting, the naming of qualifications, and the learner database, which partly the NRLD, which partly we perform through the department, because the department has HEMIS, the Higher Education Management Information System, which captures all of this data. So in one sense, that's a responsibility we have which is quite a big responsibility, but we have a conduit role because the department performs that function anyway. And then finally, the CHE, in terms of the Higher Education Act, is expected to monitor the higher education system report on trends and developments, do research on key aspects. So I want to briefly take you through to those four functions and what we've been doing and what I think some of the challenges are in the work that we've done and what we need to do going forward. In relation to the advice and monitoring functions, in practical terms in the 2009-2010 financial year, there were only two pieces of advice that the CHE was involved in. The first was advice requested by the minister on the use of the term university by higher education providers, and that advice was provided, and we're waiting for a response from the minister on the advice. And secondly, the CHE, this was not so much advice, responded to the Ministerial Committee on Racism, Transformation and the Elimination of Discrimination that came out in the course of late 2008, early 2009. In part, the advice is dependent on what the minister requests. As you know, with the establishment of a new administration in 2009, it's to be expected that while the new ministry is fleshing out what its policy intentions and priorities are, we would expect less requests for advice coming through from the ministry. The CHE has also been less proactive in providing advice. This is partly to do with trying to understand what the new priorities are, but I think it's also a weakness in the work of the CHE, which I will come back to. In terms of monitoring, the CHE, if you look at the annual report, released the state of higher education last year, which looked at trends in higher education. It has a range of other publications. It looked at issues affecting the universities of technology, issues about the role of community engagement in higher education, issues around student access and success. There was a commission, a study commission of three higher education institutions, UWC, WITS, and Pretoria, to look at what the first-year experience of students are entering. And particularly in the context of the discussion we had with the NSFAS about dropout rates, it's quite clear that one of the key issues, particularly for African students, for many of whom coming into higher education, they're the first in their families to do so, leaving aside financial issues, etc., and the issues of the school system, the very real issues about integrating and working in a different environment, particularly when they come from rural areas. So there's a whole range of where we don't fully understand what the experience is and what happens to somebody when they enter into an institution, whether our institutions are adequately equipped to address the kinds of, if you want, social context and problems that those students come into the institution with. As part of that project, we are in the process of finalizing for publication a survey that was done of, as I say, there 13,000 students at a range of institutions, again looking at the first year experience, because that seems to be quite a major problem in terms of addressing, as part of the range of other problems, funding, etc., about why we have large dropouts in higher education. We're also in the process of completing and will be holding a colloquium on the effectiveness of the LLB degree. There have been issues raised about whether the move from a five-year LLB to a four-year LLB, which happened in 1999, which was introduced by the then Minister of Justice, Dala Omar, on the grounds of increasing access to the legal profession. And there have been issues raised about whether people coming out with a four-year degree are adequately prepared for the demands of either working as an attorney or an advocate. That study is in the process of being completed. I can say to you now that in practice, it says whether you do a four-year or five-year degree in itself is not the real issue. And there's lots of other problems around the LLB degree that may explain some of the problems. I think that the advice and monitoring part of the CHE has in the recent past, in the last few years, been the weakest part of the CHE's work. CHE has concentrated pretty much on the quality assurance aspects of its work. It has not provided a lot of proactive advice. It's not done it's monitoring, so it's not monitored what I call systemic monitoring of the higher education system. So all of the policies that have been introduced in the last 10 years, the impact of those policies, how those policies have, as they've been implemented, what the consequences of those policies have been, have not been monitored by the CHE. In part, it had to do with the shift in the CHE as it moved towards quality assurance and introducing a new quality assurance system, it lost sort of focus about the monitoring part. The monitoring directorate itself was unstaffed for a long time until last year, and effectively as we stand, it's not operating at full capacity. So it's an area that we certainly need to take a lot more seriously and focus on. In terms of areas of future work linked to monitoring, I'm just highlighting these are things we've identified partly in context of discussions, both with the ministry coming out of the ministerial summit, as well as in discussions with vice chancellors in the last few months. The one area that is reported on in the annual report on the undergraduate curriculum, the review of whether the current 3-year degree structure is appropriate, we had not taken that work forward largely because we were seeking clarity about whether the minister formally requested advice on that matter. We did meet with the minister 2 weeks ago, the council met with the minister, and we will be taking forward as part of our work next year a major investigation as to whether we require to rethink the undergraduate qualifications that we offer, whether it's appropriate given the big gap from school to university to higher education, not only as it's commonly assumed for African students, but for all students. So all of our students take many more years to complete a 3-year undergraduate qualification than should be expected. The norm is about 5 years in general across the different groups. The other areas we're exploring, well, obviously the key in terms of the post-school system is the relationship between FET colleges and higher education programs. The changing nature of the academic profession, you know, the clear problems we face about whether we're producing the next generation of academics. As you know, people talk about the fact that we have an aging white male professoriate, and where are we getting the new people, the new blood, if you want, coming into the system. So it's a big issue going forward in the next decade or so. And there are a whole range of issues around the effectiveness of institutional forums, which were established at a particular time. They clearly tend not to be functioning in most institutions. In the case of SRCs, there have been issues more recently about SRC elections, where the political organizations are able to stand for elections, etc., which I think is unconstitutional. But there are issues about how SRCs get elected and the structures. The issues of rural institutions that have come up in our work, particularly in certain cases where the land is communal land, where the chief has quite a lot of authority about what the institution can and can't do with the land. So there are issues of that sort in some of our rural institutions that we need to look at more carefully. The benchmark tests and the relationship between the benchmark tests and the NSC, as you know, is a hot issue currently. And I'm just listing these. I'm not saying we're necessarily going to work in all of those areas. We're exploring, and we will have to prioritize within that, given our capacity and resources that we have. But these are the kinds of issues going forward that we are looking at. As far as moving to the quality assurance, the institutional audits that I referred to, we are coming to the end of the first round of audits. By the middle of next year, we would have conducted audits of all 23 public higher education institutions, and we've done audits of about 10 of the large private providers of higher education. In the last financial year, we had concluded UJ and UNISOM. As part of the audits, once the institution receives a report, they submit an improvement plan on the issues that have been highlighted, and there's ongoing engagement between the CHE and the institutions about the improvement plans, what the progress has been made in implementing the issues they've identified. But what I want to focus on, two things. We're now starting to think, and we 2 weeks ago had a week-long series of consultations with higher education institutions about the next round of audits, which will start in 2012. In the first round, we've largely looked at institutional systems and processes. You know, what do they do for certification? Do they have a proper process, proper security systems in place? The exam systems, do they use external examiners? A whole range of systems and policies, whether those are in place or not. So that gives you a fairly macro picture of what the institution is doing. It doesn't really drill down, if you want, as to what happens in the classroom. And really, if you want to focus on quality and enhancing quality, it's there where you need to start interacting, looking at the curriculum, how the curriculum is taught, what the nature of the interaction, the kinds of materials that are provided. So what we want to look in the second cycle is to focus more narrowly on teaching and learning. It's not to look at the institutional systems, but if you want to do case studies either in particular faculties or particular disciplines, looking more carefully at what underpins teaching and learning, how the curriculum is translated and developed, kinds of materials, what are the processes, learning and teaching processes that take place. So that hopefully would give us a better understanding, again, partly to address the issue of dropouts, throughput rates, and so forth. I think the big challenge that we face with quality assurance in the way that it's developed, if you're familiar with the higher education policy, the current policy framework, there are three tools. Government talks of steering the higher education system using a set of tools. One is funding. Funding is an important tool. The second is planning. As you know, the department has an annual enrollment planning exercise where they engage with higher education institutions about what their enrollments are going to be, what their size is going to be, and what disciplines they're going to enroll students, and they agree on a three-year plan, which is linked to the funding system. And the third plank of this steering is quality assurance. So the CHE in the last 5 years has done, as I said, we're just about to conclude the final audits of institutions. There's a rich source of information in there about issues, problems, challenges, areas of concern, and so forth. But for a range of reasons, there hasn't been the kind of interaction, close interaction, between the CHE and the department about what is coming out of this audit. So in the planning and funding system, there's a gap currently. And we think we need to, this is a matter we've raised both with the minister and the officials in the department more recently, to create a better synergy between the two arms so that the quality assurance work that we do can feed into the planning and funding. So for instance, the minister at the meeting with the CHE wanted to get information on some of the intractable governance problems in a range of our institutions that seem to appear year in and year out. And we have information that comes out of the audits where if we were to distill that, we should be able to indicate to the minister at least what the work that we're doing suggests. There may not be all the answers, but we're not currently making use in a system policy sense all of the tools that we have and the information that we have at our disposal. So that's a big challenge that we think going forward we need to take. The second part of quality is program accreditation. In the last financial year, we accredited and considered about 250 programs. So it's a fairly large number of programs that come. It's a fairly well-oiled machine. We do that throughout the year. The accreditation committee now meets almost every month. The programs come in, they go to evaluators, they come back to the committee. So it's a fairly intensive and onerous process. We've also partly linked to the department's requirements for private providers, had to re-accredit the programs of 250 private provider programs in the last year. I think the problem that we face with the accreditation system is it's very much largely a paper-driven, electronic-driven system at the moment, where we get the documentation, we assess it on paper. We're not able to make, if you want, qualitative assessments by going to every private provider in the country. There are large numbers of providers. We're only able to do so either when problems are identified, where we get information either from the public and so forth about particular problems, where we then do site visits and do an assessment and set conditions of institutions if there are problems with the quality of what they're doing. We also, with the HEQF, the Higher Education Quality Qualification Framework, which was promulgated in 2008, every higher education program now has to be aligned with this new qualifications framework. As you know, previously in the NQF, there were 8 levels, but the highest level, level 8, was a PhD. With the new NQF Act, there are 10 levels to the NQF, so the PhD is now a level 10 qualification. So institutions have to align their current qualifications in line with the new qualifications framework. By and large, well, let me put it this way, there are about 20,000 qualifications in higher education currently, which have to be converted if you want. We think that about 80% of those qualifications, if you want, can be done fairly mechanically, that they can be easily linked to the new qualifications level without any new without recurriculation. The other 20 or 30% may require recurriculation. We have got a target. We've again been discussing. We've recently released a framework for undertaking this work, which we've been talking to institutions about. We think it's going to be a 2 or 3 year project, which will be concluded in 2011. In terms of, I want to focus quickly on national reviews. Somebody earlier referred to the MBA. Now, the national review is a focus or where you look at a particular discipline. In that case, it was the MBA, where the CHE looked at every MBA program in the country, at every institution, both public and private. It was a peer-driven process. It was to assess what was being done, what is an appropriate standard for an MBA. And on the basis of that, some programs were de-accredited because they were not up to standard. In other cases, there were conditions were set and a time frame established for the institution to upgrade its program, and so forth. We've done it now. It was done for the MBA and it was done for teacher education qualifications. Now, it's a very important aspect because you really drill down to quality in the way that you don't do when you're looking at systems as a whole. The problem for the CHE has been both has been a staffing issue. A lot of the staff who were involved with national reviews, Sam was talking about people leaving SACWA and going to other bodies. Some of them left the CHE and joined the department, and so that whole function, in a sense, partly came to a standstill because of staffing issues, but also because of funding issues. There was not adequate funding for that particular aspect of the CHE's work. We are currently doing an organizational review, and we're redirecting resources so that from next year onwards, we will re-establish the National Reviews Directorate so we can do further work. The one area, again, because it's been mentioned by one of the members, that was planned to have happened in the work was precisely social work. To look at that, that had been planned but had been put to a stop because of the resource constraints at the time. So if we do re-establish this directorate, it's more than likely because all the groundwork had been done, that social work would be the first area that we would focus on. In terms of the qualification framework, that is the new functions of the CHE, we have just released a request for the sector to make submissions on the higher education qualifications framework. You may be aware there have been concerns about whether the current framework meets all of the needs of the different qualifications that we require. So to give you two examples, in the case of health, there's been a concern by the Department of Health and institutions that the qualifications framework currently does not provide for a two-year diploma, which is more appropriate to a whole range of auxiliary health services than the three-year diploma. In the case of the universities of technology, they've raised issues about the lack of a technological qualifications stream in the HEQF. So we are asking institutions, professional bodies, and so forth to make submissions about what they think are the gaps in the HEQF, and we hope as part of that process to make recommendations to the minister in the middle of next year, because the minister finally determines the qualifications framework. Standard setting, which is a new function, we currently in the process of conceptualizing what we need to do in the standard setting framework, and we hope to get that process off the ground next year. And then, Chair, finally, if I can move quickly to some financial issues. The CHE, as you know, is primarily dependent on government funding. In the 2009-10 financial year, it was allocated just under 33 million rand. The public donations are not really donations. You've seen the report. We had two or three years ago did a project on commission by UNESCO, which took us a long time to get UNESCO to pay for the work that we had done. It finally came in last year, and in discussion with the auditors, we had to reflect it in some fashion, and it was reflected as a public donation. The other income, we do charge private providers for the service that we provide in terms of accreditation, and we have some interest income in there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time currently. I know the big issue in the past and at the meeting last year was around consulting fees. as you know, a large part of our work around accreditation is using evaluators, and that we identify as consulting fees. We also have, in terms of current assets, cash in hand. We had about 10 million rand at the end of last year. That was largely the ministry had allocated to the CHE at the end, in January or February of this year, 9 million rand for the new functions as a quality council. And because that has not been given effect and implemented, that money, in a sense, is sitting in an interest-bearing account until we get that project off the ground. So in that sense, we had surplus funds which the Treasury had approved, including investing those funds because of the need because of the need to develop that particular function. Finally, Chair, just looking, these are not in percentage terms. I think we do have issues in terms of, although we have a very small senior management and the next level, the director level, where in total currently there are six staff members. So issues of race are an issue. We are better represented, including at senior management, in terms of gender. But the big problem that we face currently is we have large numbers of vacancies. We have a capacity problem, but we also have large numbers of vacancies. In that diagram, as you see, we have 13 unfilled posts. We are in the process currently. There are organizational issues at the CHE. The organizational issues, particularly in terms of staff development, the kinds of staff we've recruited, and so forth. So we are currently undertaking a fairly major exercise looking at at our organizational effectiveness, what are the kinds of people that we need, and the people that we have, what sort of training that they require. So for instance, in monitoring, we've got some junior staff who by and large don't understand the policy context in higher education as it's developed over the last 10 years. So we've been running internal in-house programs to bring them up to speed. We're also looking in relation to our staffing at our salary structure. We work within the public service. There had been a suggestion that we may want to look particularly at the senior levels because we're competing with higher education institutions and the salary structures in institutions seem to be better. It's not absolutely clear to me at the moment. Better than the public service. I'm not convinced by that, but we're currently doing a benchmarking exercise, all of which we hope to take to the council by the end of this year. So, Chair, in conclusion, let me say we are going through a period, if you want. I said to the minister when he met the council that when new ministers come into place, they tend to restructure, they create new organograms. So in the same way, when a new CEO comes into place, it's also an opportunity to look at what we have. We've had organizational issues and problems, not dissimilar to some of the kinds of problems that have faced the NSFAS previously. And so we've appointed an HR manager to ensure that we have proper systems and policies in place, that we're able to develop our staff, and so forth. Thank you. Oh, sorry, we have a clean audit. But as you can see, the CHE is a fairly simple organization. In terms of the financial issues, etc., that impact on it.
Thanks so much, Mr. Issa. We've got a challenge, if I'm right, that the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education is meeting at what time? 2:00. So I will not necessarily allow every member. I think we've apologized up front that we didn't have a choice to have all three submissions today, because of the pressures of this particular period, not around November or so, but in a sense to ensure that we also reflect on the budgetary expenditure process. So, is there any members that would want to recover?
Thank you very much for the report. It's on the financials. I'm trying to understand one thing here. Maybe coming from the reports of the CTAs, they would say, you know, our admin must not be more than this percentage. I'm not sure if there is that requirement. But also, I'm trying to understand why they have a line item called admin costs. And then admin expenses, that's the word they're using. And then you have employee costs. I would have thought employee costs means salaries. and therefore that's part of administration. I want to understand why the split.
My question is on the lack of legislation regarding private and public partnerships in higher education. Why is there no legislation regarding these partnerships? It's a common thing in government service, so could you please give me an answer on that? The other one is the LLB, your remarks on the LLB. You said the four-year course is not necessarily the problem, but other problems. Could you please give us some more background on that? I'm particularly interested in that. Another question is, who trains the lecturers at university? Teachers need to have a professional qualification. I'm concerned about the fact that a lecturer doesn't need any qualification whatsoever. And then in the fourth place, curriculum development. You mentioned curriculum development at universities. Do you have courses in curriculum development at universities in the first place? And secondly, who's responsible for your curriculum development at universities, and do they get trained? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Chip and I respond. In relation to, this was just to try to get the information onto a page, but if you look at page 70 of our detailed income statement, what is identified as administration expenses are things like printing, stationery, telephones, insurance, all of the things. So it was very just to capture onto one slide without giving you the long page. So in that sense, we use admin expenses. The employee costs are salaries. So it's not separating. It's just trying to capture the information easily. And there are a whole range of things, you know, security, insurance, all of that goes into that. In relation to the, I think the issues around lecturers and curriculum development, I think it's one of the problems, well, let me say not a problem, one of the challenges of higher education is that unlike teacher training, or unlike the school education system, or even unlike other professions, whether you become a lawyer or a doctor, you go through a period of training. In higher education, your period of training tends to be the studying towards a doctorate. It's a very focused, very isolated, very specialized training in terms of doing research. So there's no formal training required of an academic or a lecturer who starts teaching, including training in curriculum development. Many of our institutions have now started staff development programs where they have teaching and learning centers, which offers assistance to academics, to lecturers, in terms of how they should develop their curriculum, how they should teach it, and so forth. But there isn't a formal requirement currently in place. Now, it's something that clearly is a challenge. It's a problem across higher education across the world. Some countries are beginning to think about making it a prerequisite, that you may have to have a formal qualification post doing your PhD or whatever, a one-year qualification of some sort. In some cases, some institutions do offer postgraduate diplomas in higher education teaching, but that's not compulsory. So it's purely voluntary on the members of staff that they want to. In the case of the LLB, there are a range of issues and problems. Some of it has to do with the way the curriculum is structured, the amount of time within the curriculum that's allocated for different parts of the different modules that people have to do. There are problems about the kind of course materials that you use. So there are a whole range of issues. We are just finalizing the report. I haven't seen the full report, so I was just giving you a glimpse of it. We are holding a colloquium on the 11th of November, and we'd be in a position to extend an invitation to members of the committee. As far as the public, I wasn't quite sure what the issue you were raising around public-private partnerships in terms of legislation.
Currently, no legislation regarding private and public partnerships in higher education.
Just
that's a fact. Yes.
Just explain that question. What are you actually saying, member?
There's no legislation on public and private partnerships when it comes to higher education.
Explain what you understand by that.
Well, it's clear. There is no legislation in this regard. There's
legislation on what?
Yes, the cooperation between, for instance, a public and a private institution. For instance, let's take the problem with the Huguenot College in Wellington. And for instance, the university.
Okay.
There's no legislation allowing a partnership between such a college and a university. And why is there no legislation in this regard?
Maybe, Mishwana, I thought you were asking a question before you run.
Yeah.
Or you're waving. Okay. Okay, it's meeting. That's the,
yeah,
okay, cool. Okay,
yeah.
So you want to. No, it's fine. Okay, cool. Yeah, I think there's issues of correctness also of, yeah. On that particular issue, did you want to come in, Acting Director General?
Mm. I just wanted to explain that there is legislation not about partnerships between public and private, because in the past there was misuse of the subsidy and double counting. But the institution and the reference that you particularly are interested in, they have been at a meeting with the department where they were informed of the process in order to register and what the regulatory requirements are, and they've chosen not to register.
In other words, there is legislation.
Yeah, there's a regulatory environment that manages these
institutions.
Okay. That's why I thought of zooming in on what you, for your clarification, because it's possibly to do with something very specific, and therefore there can be an assumption, but there is a regulatory environment
okay.
that manages these processes. Let me, thank you, if you can just put on off the mic. Any last comments from your side? Let me thank the Council for Higher Education. I saw it also last year. We didn't post too many questions to SACWA, and we didn't post too many questions to Council for Higher Education. I think the Council for Higher Education issues really for us, I've explained what it was for SACWA that earlier. For CHE, really related to the type of advice being given, and is the advice being given also is there a strategic space where CHE is engaging the ministry, and then to help with some of the questions that comes up in the public domain on policy formulation. So is CHE used appropriately in the context of higher education and training? This is not necessarily with the current department, but also over the last couple of years. Or is there underutilization? Those were the type of issues that we confronted ourselves with then as a committee. And then you've tackled some of the other issues in relation. Members, let's then thank the two institutions here for job well done. As you're saying, it's quite clear CHE's role and responsibilities and also the financial processing around it. However, there is instruments that shows why it's working, and I think that is possibly this pockets of excellence even within the family of higher education. Not the pockets of excellence on that Samuel referred to earlier, but even SACWA being a pocket of excellence in the context of the CETA landscapes and the other institutions in higher education and training, the same for CHE. We'll take those lessons forward as we will proceed. Thanks so much. Members, we will be meeting tomorrow at 2 or 4 so that we can actually look at the budgetary review and recommendations of this committee into the parliamentary process and parliament. That's at 2 o'clock.
May I just ask on that, any preparation that you expect us to do so that we come prepared to that meeting?
There was a process where, if I'm right, Secretary, last week on Tuesday when we've met, no, Wednesday, and then on Thursday, there would be a report flowing. There will be a report, but are we getting the report in the meeting, or can we get the report earlier? Okay, it's been discussed on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, it's for adoption. So there is Wednesday and Thursday engagements that we've got. Am I right?
Yes.
Just report.
Are you also in basic education?
Yes, Chair. Tomorrow we'll table the report before the committee, and then on Thursday, that's when we are going to adopt it.
Adopt
the PRR report.
In the committee or?
In the committee.
But they are saying the Thursday is not on the program.
Yes, Chair. Chairperson, what we are going to do is actually when I discussed with Ms. Kubai, we're initially going to sit tomorrow and then just to take all the recommendations from members and then rewrite the report and submit it to Parliament straight. But she was of the opinion that perhaps we also need to sit on test as well to adopt it. So it will depend on whether members are satisfied with the actual report tomorrow. And then if they are, then we'll be able to adopt it tomorrow.
Members, this unfortunately, this period is a very difficult period, just in terms of time framing. What the WIP is suggesting is very practical. If we are getting the consolidated version tomorrow of the report, and we feel and we're making suggestions and interventions, and that needs to be rewritten, there is then a need for Thursday just to have a quick half an hour meeting for the adoption of that report. That's essentially what. However, if we are accepting the report as is, we will not have a need for the Thursday meeting. And that's really the difference here.
Chairperson, can I then therefore suggest that if people have any inputs, that we perhaps give it through to our secretary before tomorrow's meeting, say before 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, so that when we go to the meeting tomorrow, that we will have a draft which we can work from, and hopefully when we go, depart, that we will be fairly happy, or that we will hopefully all be happy with what has been agreed to.
Accepted. I think if we can, then we need to make submissions before 10, and we'll communicate that to our members as well. Thanks so much.